Morning, everyone. Today's daf in Ksuvus is Pei Aleph. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is Lona Zeichon Ishmachliba, Gabriela Bashmuel. We found ourselves back on Pei Amud Aleph. Nifsei Malug has been the topic of discussion that we've had. Nifsei Malug, as we already know the basics, but quickly to review, the Nifsei Malug is property that she brings into the marriage, property she does not write into the Ksuva, but rather she just simply retains it. Or any properties that she acquires after she's married, meaning during her marriage. So these properties are hers, but the husband enjoys the peiros. Enjoys the peiros, what I really mean is that he owns the peiros. We're going to be talking later this morning about to the extent of his ownership. What exactly does ownership entail, although that seems like a pretty straightforward question, but you'll see later on that it's going to be a little bit complex in terms of his ownership of those peiros. But in the meantime, however, those peiros belong to him. And that means that the peiros belong to him, so then it's his basic operative responsibility to work the land. So she comes in into the marriage with the property, and he's going to get the peiros. So who's going to work the land? She's going to work the land? She's not going to work the land, so he's going to work the land. So then we get on to a discussion that we had yesterday regarding an aris, regarding a sharecropper. Generally speaking, a sharecropper works the land, so there's profit sharing. Here, however, there is no profit sharing. He's the husband. He's not working just anybody's field. He's working his wife's field. So therefore, as we pointed out yesterday, so on one hand, he's going to enjoy the peiros. On the other hand, he's going to work the land. He's not going to get reimbursed. Furthermore, we also pointed out yesterday in the Mishnah that he's not going to get reimbursed, and there's no balance sheet whatsoever. Meaning that even if, let's say, they get a divorce, we learned it yesterday in the Mishnah, and that means then that he's going to look at his wife and say, look, you know, it was unfortunately didn't work out, but let's go over the expense sheet now. Okay, so I took out this much from the land, and this is how much I invested into the land, and right now I'm entitled to a lot of money. So the Mishnah says he's not. Mishnah says that as a marriage and this financial responsibility, this financial arrangement that exists between husband and wife is such that there is simply no balance sheet. In other words, he's going to get the peiros, he'll invest whatever he invests into the land, and we simply do not we do not make a reckoning at the end of the day in terms of who walked away with more. That is the nature of Nechsei Malug. What it then means, as the Gemara pointed out yesterday, is that even if he takes one grogerus, if he takes one date and eats one date, so now he is invested in this relationship as Nechsei Malug, and as such, he's not going to get any reimbursement whatsoever. With that, let's go right into the Gemara. Ha'iyisa somewhere in Pei Amud Aleph, and we start with a story today about a woman, Denafla Arba Me'azuzei Be'chuzai. Now she has an inheritance, she's married, and while she's married, she gets an inheritance from Beit Chuzai. I don't know where Beit Chuzai is, and that's not important for this discussion. It's far away. And so basically now he's going to travel in order to go to Beit Chuzai in order to get her Yerusha of 400 Zuz. Also, Gavra Apik Shismea. Now the husband had travel expenses, and the travel expenses were 600 Zuz in order to get the 400 Zuz. Now, if you're wondering to yourself, this does not sound like a smart business model, so the only thing I will do is just simply concur and say, I agree. And meanwhile, I see Arba Mea Behade de Ka'ase, I'm sorry, I see Mea Arba Mea. So he's bringing now the 400 back. Behade de Ka'ase Yitzrech Lechad Zuz. So now on his return, so there was still one little more traveling needed to be done. He needed another zuz. So what did he do? He took from the 400 inheritance, and he took one zuz out of the 400, so leaving only 399, and in order to pay for the travel. Also, coming to Rabbi Ami. Now the matter came in front of Rabbi Ami. Amar lei, masha hoti hoti, masha acha acha. Now Rabbi Ami's first reaction to this is, you know what just happened? He just enjoyed the peros of that Yerusha. And now, it's since he enjoyed the peiros of the Yerusha, so what did we learn back in the Mishnah? So there's no longer a balance sheet. And because there's no longer a balance sheet, what about all those expenses that he put in? And he put in a tremendous expense in order to get that money. He put in 600 zuz in order to get that money. So now, he, although he would look for his wife for reimbursement of those travel expenses, but because he enjoyed the peiros, so therefore he's going to get none of the travel expenses.
Is the principle?
So, Amru le Rabbanan le Rabbi Ami, Hani milahecha dekacha pera. So the Gemara says, yes, that's correct. I agree with you. But that's only if he ate the peros. But ha karna ka'achel. But over here, he didn't eat peros, he ate principal. In other words, what he was doing was he was borrowing against the principal in order to help pay for some of those travel expenses. He didn't take peros, that was Karen. So im kein havale hotzi v'lo'achel, yishav kama hotzi v'yitol. So the Gemara says, Rabbi Ami says, good clarification, that's correct. He did not take peros. parts, and you're right. And so therefore, he's entitled to reimbursement. Now, by the way, the Gemara ends the discussion over here, but if we just continue it for just one more moment, that reimbursement that he's going to get is not going to be 600. Because although he did lay out 600 in order to get that 400, but his claim for reimbursement cannot exceed the profit that he got. And what was the profit that he got? He only brought back 400. So, in other words, even in Rabbi Ami's clarification that he is entitled to reimbursement, but certainly he's not entitled to the reimbursement of 600. Okay.
If he borrowed from the 400, isn't that considered Pharaoh's debt? In other words, because he borrowed, he did the traveling and gets it back.
Well, I said the word borrowed, that's true, but really what he did is he took from the 400 in order to pay for that last expense with the, I guess it is borrowing. In other words, with the intention of taking it back. But in other words, but he dipped into the principal. It was not a derivative. It wasn't a dividend off the Karen. Okay. Now, in the Mishnah, if he doesn't enjoy the peros, so now the relationship is not a nechze malug relationship, but rather, says the Mishnah, he's got to he just simply now makes a claim. He hands in his receipts and he says, "This is how much I laid out," and therefore he's entitled to reimbursement. And the Mishnah says, but handing in the receipts is not enough. He also has to make a shvuah as well. Now a shvuah is made over here. It's not a shvuah in the Torah, but still, whenever you see the word shvuah, that means we don't fully trust him. We're not particularly sure that this is how much he laid out.
Shvuah is on what?
You make a shvuah that those receipts are accurate receipts. And you know, you're not overbilling, double billing, right? Or just making up bills. So in other words, whenever you see the word shvuah, that means that we don't perfectly trust him. And so therefore, just to give us a sense of confidence that he's saying the truth, so therefore you make a shvuah. Rabbi Asi makes the following comment. V'hu she'ei shevach keneged hotzah. Correct. He makes a shvuah, but only if the shevach corresponds to the hotzah. Obviously, by him working in land, there's going to be appreciation of the land. The expenses are whatever his expenses are. If they're equal to one another, so then he has to make a shvuah. Now, Rabbi Asi's comment is not perfectly clear what that means. To which the Gemara now wants clarification on what did he mean? Lamai hilchasa. So that's exactly the Gemara's question. What halacha is he speaking about? I'm Rabbi Shimai Yeshevach Yeser Alotza Notolotza Below Shvuah. Let's say he did a good job and there was a good appreciation of land, and actually the appreciation of the land exceeded his expenses. Again, we're going back to the Mishnah. We're talking about a case where he's not eating a single pri. He didn't eat any of the peros, and therefore he's entitled to get a reimbursement for his expenses. If right now what the Gemara is suggesting is that if his expenses are less than the appreciated value of the land, so then not only is he going to get his expenses, but he doesn't have to make a shvuah. And the idea behind this is, look, in other words, good for him, meaning he improved the land, and he laid out expenses, and all he wants to do is get reimbursed, and he's not taking more away from her, because she has now an appreciated land that's greater than whatever the receipts are that he's submitting. So good. So he can take it without making a shvuah.
So what happens to the
pears? We're talking about a case. We're only talking about a case right now where he didn't take the pears. If he took the pears, and then there's no, then he's not handing in his receipts.
If the appreciation is less than his...
I'm sorry. Let me just get through this. So halotza no tosa halotza below shvua. Amalei Rava im kein asi le'erume. So Rava says, I don't like your understanding of Rabbi Asi, because what comes out is as follows. You're telling me that anytime he's handing in receipts and it's less than the appreciated value of the land, he doesn't have to make a shvua. Interesting. So you know what? Let's imagine that, just for number's sake, let's say that the land was, he put work into the land and the land went up in value by 1,000. Okay, I'm just throwing numbers out. And let's say he only invested $500 into the land. Oh, and really, and I don't have to make a shvuah? Okay, so I'll just, you know what, just I'll add a couple of dollars. I'll just add a couple more receipts. I'll bring the number up to 900. 900, good. So in other words, and I don't have to make a shvuah? Okay, so you know what, I'll cook the books just a little bit in order to help myself to just a little bit more and think about it. In other words, I worked, and it's where I worked hard, and you know, that was toil out there. So Elam Arava, so Arava says, okay, Rava does not accept that understanding of Rabbi Asi. So Rav is going to give his own understanding of Rabbi Asi. Shim Haisa Hotza Yisrael Shevach Ein Lo Ela Hotza Shir Shevach Uvishvua. What Rabbi Asi meant is as follows. Anytime that he's entitled to submit receipts, and again, the only time he's entitled to submit receipts is if he doesn't take peros. Anytime he's entitled to take receipts, what he must do is he must make a shvua. In other words, that is something where we're not totally trusting in the fact that all his receipts are honest and he's going to be totally and he's going to be totally sincere and truthful about it, so he must make a shvua. And what Rabbi Asi is telling us is as follows. He can only bill up to appreciated value. He cannot bill above appreciated value. That's what Rabbi Asi is saying, is that we're capping his allowance in order of what he can collect in terms of his expenditure. It can't be greater than the appreciated value. Yeah.
But my question is, what if it's less? Does he have to swear at by
Bani? No, so right now, according to the new understanding of Rabbi Asi, yeah. He always is going to have to make a shvua, no matter what it is. And now the only thing that Rabbi Asi is telling us is that you can't collect more than the appreciated value. Okay, let's say the husband does as follows. Husband now marries a woman, nichsem look property. If he works the property, so we all know, so he'll get the peros and good. And if he doesn't collect the peros, then he can submit receipts. Fine. What if the husband says, you know, I'm not going to work the land, bring in the sharecroppers. And what he does is he subcontracts and he gets sharecroppers to work the land. Now, normally, sharecroppers are involved in profit sharing. Over here, these sharecroppers are coming in under the auspices of the husband. And so the question, it's a traditional question in the Gemara, when they're coming in under the husband, so do they assume the same rules and regulations of the husband? Or do they assume the rules and regulations of a regular sharecropper in profit sharing? That's the Gemara's question.
Who did they have a relation with? The husband? Or
husband brought them in. The Gemara says the husband brought them in. Baal Shaor a recent tachtav mahu. I died to the Baal Nachas. So are they going in with the mindset of the husband? Yisalik Baal Estalka Lahu. So that means that if the husband can be shooed off. Shooed off meaning, in this context, means the husband's not profit sharing. Meaning when the husband works the land, the only thing that he gets is payers. And there's no, and there's no share, and there's no splitting of the profit. And by profit sharing, by the way, not only do the sharecroppers get a profit of the yield, they also get a share in the profit of the appreciated value of the land. So what the Gemara now is suggesting is that if they're coming in under the auspices, under the umbrella of the husband, so just like the husband only gets peros, they too only get peros. Oh, Dilma daita da aranachis. Or the Gemara says, or maybe no. Maybe they're coming in for the land, meaning as sharecroppers. Va'ariki kaime larisa kaime. And this land was intended for sharecropping, meaning it needed to be harvested. And so here comes the sharecroppers, and therefore they're going to go in with the normal rate of profit sharing that a sharecropper comes in for. So matzkel of Rabbi Barav Chanan Maishname Hayor Latoch Sadeh Chaver Venata Shlabrishus Shamim Lov Yadol Atachtona. The Gemara here quotes the Mishnah Bab Metzia. The Mishnah Bab Metzia gives us the basic rules regarding sharecropping. Now there basically are. This is an area where I don't want to delve too far into, but they're basically and because. First of all, to be totally honest, I do not remember this Mishnah Bab Metzia. It's been a while. We're closer to it in the future than we were in the past. But there are basically two categories of sharecroppers. One who go in with permission of the owner. One who go in without permission. Now, without permission, that's funny. Correct. What does that mean, without permission? It means that the land is there and it's laying fallow. No, they're not coming in as owners. They're coming in just to work the land. And the Mishnah Bab Metzia describes how, right now, if they don't come in, no one's going to come in. So what they do is, as a capitalist, is that they see an opportunity, they take advantage of an opportunity, but they weren't authorized to do so. What are they entitled to? So this is the Mishnah Bab Metzia. Hayor l'zoch sadeh chaver v'natzah shlo b'rishus. If they go in without permission, shaman lo v'yado ala tachtona. So there is a formula in terms of determining how much money they're going to get. They're not going to get the tried and true regular profit-sharing revenue of a sharecropper, but they're going to get something. Okay, and for the time being, let's just simply suffice by saying they'll get something. So the Gemara wonders, even if we're going to call them, even if they're not going in under the auspices of the husband, and even if they're going in on their own, aren't they, don't they fall under this category of, you know, sharecroppers who are going in, but not under the authority of the woman? So the Gemara says, yeah, but over here, look, from the wife's perspective, look, I know I came in with nichsim look property, but you know what I also did? I also married a husband, meaning my expectation was, you're going to work the land, meaning this is the relationship that we have. I come in with property, and I expected you to work the land, and not somebody else to work the land. My Havilah, the Gemara says, okay, let's get a halach over here. I'm Rav Huna Bereid, Rav Yeshua Chazinan. So the Gemara does not give one objective halacha, but the Gemara says it's going to depend. What is it going to depend on? Ibal arisu istalek bal sa'akalahu. So the Gemara says, look, if the husband himself knew how to work a land, and he himself was a sharecropper, and he understood basically how to do it, so the Gemara says that when the sharecroppers are coming in under him, meaning it's something he could have done. And for whatever reason, whatever time, energy, he didn't want to do it. So there, the sharecroppers are coming in under the auspices of the husband, because this is something the husband himself could have done. And therefore, they're going to follow the same formula that the husband follows, which is that if they take payros, they don't get any reimbursement. And if they don't take payros, so then they'll get then they'll be able to hand them the receipts, but no greater than what the shevach is. Iba lava resu. Now let's say he's not a farmer by trade, and the husband that she married simply has no idea how to share crop, and now he's subcontracts. So the Gemara says, "Ara la risa kaime." There they're coming in not under the auspices of the husband, because this is not something the husband could have done. So therefore, anyway, they would have had to hire sharecroppers for the land, and so therefore they're going to follow the regular formula of a sharecropper. Okay. Okay, we are winding down over here, but still the Gemara's got a couple more questions that it has regarding the husband's rights to peiros of his wife. Gemara asks the following question. Can the husband sell peiros of the land? Now, when the Gemara is asking over here, selling the peiros of the land, what the Gemara means by this is that, take a look at the last Rashi in the Amud, Machalachem Karka Malug Shiyase Alokech V'yochal Peiros. He's selling the right to work the land and to collect peiros for themselves. Meaning, the husband has a right to work the land and to collect the peiros. Okay, right, responsibility, you know, a little bit of both. And now, what the Gemara wants to know is, look, can he just go to somebody and say, here, those peiros belong to me, and I'm going to sell for you the rights to work the land so that you can go ahead and collect the peiros. So kita kino, I skipped the line. Sorry, mahu. Mi amrina mai dekane akne. So on one hand, the Gemara says, look, he is rightfully entitled to those peiros. They're his. So if they're his, he could sell them. Odilma kita kino la rabban peiros la baal mishum revach besa avol zvune lo. And here we get now to the complexity, to the sophistication of his ownership of the peiros. What the Gemara is suggesting now, as the other side of this question, is that maybe it's true he does own the peiros, but with restriction. And those restrictions are, you're the owner, but really you're expected to bring those peiros back into the house. Meaning, really what the Chachamim intended, again, the Gemara is not being clear about this, this is one side of the question, but maybe what the Chachamim intended with the idea of Nichsei Malug and him getting the peiros is that he'll get the peiros and then what? And then he brings them home. Meaning he goes out to the field, he works the field, he gets all these peiros, and then he brings them home. And obviously once home, he's going to share them with his wife. And the Gemara is suggesting now that really what's behind peiros, yes, he's the owner, and yes, he gets them, but really with the letter of the law is he owns it, but the spirit of the law, though, it's a little bit more than spirit right now, the spirit of the law is, but you're expected to bring them home so that everyone can enjoy them. This is what's called revach beis.
He's also bringing them.
Huh?
The money, if he sells it, he also brings it home.
Stay tuned. Stay tuned. Excellent point. The Gemara is going to make that point. So aval zvuni lo. So Yehuda mar bar marima mishmei derava amar masha asal sui. So the Gemara has a dispute amongst the Amorim whether or not he could sell the rights of the peiros to somebody else. So Yehuda, Marbere Maremar, says he could sell it, although he doesn't really say that. He says, Masha Asa Asui. I don't recommend that he do this, but if he does it, it's sold. Rav Papa, Amar Mishmei Rav Lo Asa Velo Klum. And Rav Papa says, no, he cannot. Am Rav Papa, Had Yehuda, Marbere Maremar, La Befer Shidmar, Ela Mechlala Inmar. And then Rav Papa goes on to say, and you know, the truth of the matter is, my Bar Plukta, the person I'm arguing with, he never even really said it. But people think he holds that way based on the following incident. Gemara tells a story. This one you'll remember well past today. Okay, there was a woman who brought into the marriage two maidservants. Okay, so two shvachos he brought into the marriage, and the shvachos are malug property. Fine. So what does that mean? It means that those shvachos belong to her, but obviously the husband can enjoy the peros. Peros over here in this case means their service. So now the guy marries a second wife. So So what he did is he took one of his shvachos and he gives it to his other wife. So just to make sure that we process what just happened over here, not only did it bring and introduce the second wife into the marriage, so that's already insult number one to the first wife, but he took one of the shvachos of the first wife and he basically earmarked her for the second wife, because look, he does have the rights to the services, meaning the nichse malug do belong to him. So therefore, the peros of the nichse malug belong to him. So he just simply assigned those peros, in this case the service, to his other wife. Second wife. That maidservant that was brought in by the first wife. That is called adding insult to injury. So she goes to Rava, the first wife, and she says to Rava, this is simply not right. And Rava's response is, okay. I'm really sorry, but he has the rights. It's within his right. So now the Gemara says, look, the casual observer of this story is going to say, why didn't Rava respond? You know why? Because as it relates to Peros, he can do whatever he wants with the Peros. And even if it means selling, selling it to another party, he could do that. The Gemara says, Velohi. But the Gemara says, but that conclusion based on this story is not a correct conclusion. Mishum Revach Besa. Because the truth of the matter is that he didn't take the Peros of his first wife and just simply send them off somewhere else or sell them to an outsider. He kept her in the house. It's, in other words, it's with the one husband. Okay, this I know it's gonna sound a little strange, but this is what polygamy is. It's one husband, it's two wives, it's two maidservants. Nothing changed. They're still here. It's just, in other words, he's just simply assigning one to the other, but it's still revach besa. In other words, the payers are still in house, and that satisfies, so to say, the spirit of the law. Of Peros, and so therefore, Rava was fine with this. Rava may not necessarily be fine with him selling the Peros to an outsider. The Revach Beisav HaKaravach the Hilchasa, and now the Gemara comes to a conclusion in this matter. So the Gemara says that the husband cannot sell the Peros. Cannot. So it's good. So we have a conclusion of the Gemara that the husband's rights and ownership of the peros is an ownership, but with restriction. And the restriction is that there is an intent. There's the intent of the law is that, yes, he owns the peros, but the intent of the law is that he brings them back into the house, and it provides more surplus for the house. Now, my taima. It's funny. The Gemara now asks the question, why can't he sell the peros? It's funny. After the Gemara just had the discussion, don't we know the answer? But the Gemara is going to introduce another idea as well in terms of why it is that he can't sell the peros. So Abaye says, you know why he can't sell it? Because what's going to happen is as follows. The husband's going to take good care of the land. A husband's going to look to get as much yield and at the same time not exploit the land. If he sells the peros to somebody else, that outsider will not take good care of the land. And so therefore, one possibility is that he can't sell the peros, And again, when I say sell the peros, I mean sell the rights for somebody else to work the land and get the peros, is because that person is not going to take good care of the land. And as Rashi points out over here, part of the reason why is because, look, I have a tenuous grasp on this land. Meaning, yes, I bought the rights to this land, but my rights only continue as long as these two are married. Once they're no longer married, I'm no longer going to be the land. So you know what? If I don't have a solid lock on this land, all right, I'll do the little that I need to do in order to get the yield, but I'm not going to really take care of the land. That's one possibility. And Rava Amar Mishum Revach Besa. And Rava says, but he sides with another reason why he shouldn't sell the pears to somebody else, because again, the intent of the law is that the husband's going to get the pears so that he brings it back into the house. Revach Besa. My Beinayuk, but now the Gemara points out that these are two separate reasons, and there would be practical differences based on these two reasons. Number one, Ara Demekar Vlamasa, let's say the land is really close to the city. So in other words, the wife can keep her eyes on what's going on that land. So if the reason is that we're worried about exploitation of the land, well, the wife is going to be walking by every day. She's going to see what's going to happen. If the outsider is exploiting the land, the wife is going to say something. If the issue is Revach Besa, so Revach Besa, doesn't matter if the land is close to the city, that the fruit is not coming back into the house, so then that would prohibit the sale. That's one practical difference. Inami Balaris, who? Or let's say the husband himself is a sharecropper. So husband itself is a sharecropper. So then, in other words, he's not selling somebody else to work the land. He himself is going to work the land. He'll take good care of it. On the other hand, he's not bringing the fruit back into the house. That's another nafkamina. Inami, zuze v'kavid b'hu iska. Danny, this is what you suggested earlier. The Gemara says, another thing to consider is the following. Let's say he does sell the rights of the field to an outsider. And what does he do with that money that he just got? That's capital. So what does he do? He goes on a venture, and he does business with that capital. So, and he's going to bring in more money into the house. So the Gemara says, so good. So on one hand, you've satisfied the spirit of the law in that the peros ended up coming back into the house and serving to generate more into the house, more abundance into the house. On the other hand, now that you outsource the land, who knows what that person's going to do with that land? So another nafkamina between these two explanations. Okay, Ad Kan. Takes us to more or less the end of the Malog discussion, although not really. We are starting now the next Mishnah. We're in Pam and Base. We're starting the new Mishnah. And now we're going to talk about Nichsei Malog as it relates to Shomer Yavam. Shomer Yavam, her husband. Now, I know this should sound familiar. Not that long ago, short 2.5 months ago, we were deep into the world of Yavamos. A lot of this should sound familiar. And the truth of the matter is, this entire Mishnah we saw back in Yavamos. So get to shake our memories a little bit. Come to me afterwards. Ask me after Shira. We'll explore. Okay, we know that when a woman has a husband and the husband dies, leaving her childless, so there's a mitzvah of Yibum. And we also know that that at that point in time, she's what's called the Shomer Yavam. She's waiting for the Yavam to do something. We know that she can't marry anybody else until the Yavam does a mitzvah of Yibum. And we also know that it may not end up being Yibum. It may be either Yibum or it may be Chalitza. Good. All the basics that we know already, we spent a couple months learning, more than a couple, in Masechta Yavam. Shomer Yavam, Shenaflo Nechasim. So let's say, as a Shomer Yavam, so she's in this now, she's in this wait and see period where she's locked and pretty much designated for her brother-in-law, and at that point in time, properties fall to her. So here we have an agreement that these are properties that are hers, exclusively hers, and she has the right to sell these properties. Now, as a curiosity, let's compare this mission to what we learned back on in the beginning of the parak. When we started our Nichsei Malug discussion, we talked about a woman who went through Erisin. What did we say regarding a woman who went through Erisin? Beis Hillel is of the opinion, which is the halacha, which is that lichatchila, she should not sell those properties as an arusa, and the reason why is because Erisin is just step one to the marriage. So therefore, there's a husband, and he's going to marry her, and therefore, Lichatchila, she shouldn't sell the property. Now, b'diavad, if she does, it's fine. The sale is a good sale. But lichatchila, she should not sell the property. So, let's ask a very simple question. When it comes to the arusa, so Beis Hillel says that lichatchila, she should not sell the property. Now we're talking about a shomer yavam, which is ostensibly the same thing. Okay, we'll obviously make a distinction, but ostensibly it's the same thing. And here, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel are in perfect agreement that she could go ahead and she could sell the property. So let's try to articulate what the difference is between the Mishnah back on Ayin Ches and our Mishnah over here. I don't have to think too hard because Tosfos himself raises this issue and Tosfos himself makes the distinction. You want to see the Tosfos? It's not here. Tosfos is back on Ayin Ches and Aleph. And Tosfos writes as following. V'yesh lomar. I'm reading Tosfos Divra Maskel Seifa, which is back on Ayin Ches and Aleph. Da'ach bevadeli nase kaima. D'chol ha'ma'arez dato Lisa. So when it comes to Erisin, so Erisin has a pretty clear destiny. Meaning, you go through Erisin, you're going to get married. So even though at this point in time, the land is hers, but her path in life is pretty clear. She's going to get married. Meaning stage two. And so as a result of that, so lichatchila she shouldn't sell that property because we pretty much know what's coming up next. Hilkach lichatchila lo timkor. Therefore, according to Beis Hillel, at least from a lichatchila standpoint, she shouldn't sell. Alfa pishi yivadai. Aval hasam kach omedes lachalitza kemo liyibum. But over here in her state of being shomeres yavam, so right now there are two paths that await her. Two possible paths that await her. Number one, Yibum, on the other hand, Chalitza. V'hol v'hi v'adai, amru chachamin detimkor lechatchila. And she's a v'adai, meaning we know that she owns the land, definitively. And now there's only a possibility that she'll go through Yibum. So therefore, at this point in time, lechatchila, she can sell the property. Now, again, going back to Yavamas, and not to belabor this point, it is although it's a point well worth belaboring, in other words, we know that there's the primary mitzvah of Yibum, and Chalitza is really only secondary. So it is interesting that Tosfos over here says that there are two avenues, and it sounds like from Tosfos that's 50-50. That point is certainly interesting, but that's Tosfos' articulation of the difference between our Mishnah and the Mishnah back on the beginning of the Perek.
There's also no Kiddushin by Yavam.
But there's no kedushin. There's no need for kedushin because as a shomeres yavam, she's right. She has a zika. She's bound. It's a quasi kedushin. It's something analogous to kedushin. Okay. Again, Tosos articulated what he thinks the difference is. Okay. Good. That's a good question. But just dealing with the basics. Mesa. Now. As a Shomer Yavam, the Mishnah now moves on to the next discussion, and that is, what if she dies as a Shomer Yavam? So she's in the state of Shomer Yavam, and for reasons known to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, she dies at that point in time. So now the question becomes, what of all of her properties? Who inherits all of her properties? As a Shomer Yavam, she's somewhere in limbo in terms of where she is. Is she connected to her Yavam? Is she connected to her own family? So here we have a debate. Beis Shammai Omrim, Yachloki Yoshe Abam, Yoshe Av. So Beis Shammai is of the opinion that there's going to be a division of her estate between the Yoshe Abal, that means the inheritors of her husband, otherwise known as the Yavam, Im Yoshe Av, together with her family. Now, see Rashi over here. I will do the following. I'm gonna fast forward a little bit in terms of this discussion. See Rashi over here for exactly what Beis Shammai means. In the meantime, however, we're gonna focus on Beis Hillel. Beis Hillel Omri Beis Hillel says. Now, when Beis Hillel makes a comment, he's gonna make really three separate comments. Nechasim becheskasam. As far as the nechasim is concerned, as far as the property is concerned, so that remains in its chazaka, in its assumed position. Okay, so two things need definition over here by Beis Hillel. First of all, nechasim, when we describe the nechasim, what is that a reference to? And then the second thing we need to define is what is the assumed position of those nechasim. So the nechasim are the nedunya. That's the dowry that was written into the ksuva. In other words, when a woman gets married, we discussed this in the past, so the father's going to write in nedunya, he's going to write in properties, and those are going to go... I'm sorry, I... The Nedunya is the next one. I'm sorry, this is talking about the Nechse Tzon Barzel. Okay, apologize. Okay. The Nechse Tzon Barzel are the Nechasim, meaning those are, again, Nechse Tzon Barzel, properties that she goes into the marriage with, where she says to the husband, you're going to write, you'll assume total ownership of these properties, you'll write the value of them in the tzuva, so that in the event of death or divorce, you're going to reimburse me for the written value into the tzuva. That's Nechse Tzon Barzel. So who do they go to after she dies? Ches Kasan, they remain in its assumed state, meaning they're by the original owner. Now, exactly what that means, that's not clear. The Gemara in Baba Basra, the Gemara over here doesn't discuss it. The Gemara in Baba Basra has a debate in terms of who the presumed owner of the Nechse Tzon Barzel is. Okay. Two, Ksuvasa, her Ksuva. Where does that go? Becheskas Yoshe Abal, that goes to the husband. Here the Ksuva is a reference to the Nedunya. So that goes to the husband. And Nechasim Yosim Ima, and as far as the Nechse Maluga are concerned, Becheskas Yoshe Av, that goes to her family. Okay, because she's the owner of the Nechse Maluga, and therefore it goes to her family. Okay. That is all the opinion of Beisal. Hiniach Echiv Ma'os. Now, let's say the following. Again, we're still talking about Hashem Reis Yavam, the husband dies. And he leaves money. So what are you supposed to do with that money? Yalakech Mem Karkavu Chaperos. So what you do with that money is you buy property with that money, and the husband's entitled to eat the peros. Now, there's a basic halacha that we're all familiar with, if you remember back in Yavamas, and that's the following. When a Yavam does the mitzvah of Yibum, so number one, he's doing the mitzvah in that he's assuming the role of his brother and that he's going to marry his wife. Two, he inherits the entire estate of his brother. Unlike in generally speaking, when a relative dies, so there is going to be an equitable distribution amongst the next of kin. So, for example, if a father dies, so his children are going to equitably divide the estate. When a brother dies childless, so either the father, or if there's no father, the brothers will make an equitable distribution of the estate. However, in the world of Yibum, we learned back in Yavamos that when the Yavam does the mitzvah of Yibum, he totally steps into the role of his brother. So that means both as the husband now of this wife and as the inheritor of the property. He assumes all the property. And and the ksuva now of his wife, he doesn't have to write a new ksuva. The ksuva of his wife is already there, and from a financial standpoint, the estate of the husband is earmarked for the payment of that ksuva. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Peres atzlushim in akarka. Now, if they were fruit that were separated from the ground, meaning this is what the dead brother left for his brother to inherit. So yilakech bem karkvu chaperos. So once again, that's considered keren, and so therefore that has to be rolled over into property, and the husband can enjoy peros. He can take the dividends. Hamuchubarn bekarka. What if it's fruit that were connected to the ground? Should sound familiar. We discussed it at the beginning of the perek. Amar Rabbi Meir shamanoso kamein yafin beperos vekamein yafin peros. So those fruit are principal. Those fruit are not considered peros, and therefore you have to figure out its value, roll that over into a property, and then he could get the peros of that property. The chachamim are of the opinion that the fruit that are connected to the ground belong to him. Okay, the talushim in a karka, and if they are disconnected from the ground, kol hakodem zachabahem. So here, when it comes to the widow, so she'll get those fruit, but only if she was zachabahem. Who zacha? I'm sorry, zachabahem. Kanam who zacha? Kadmahi yilakech mem karka v'hu ochaperos. So here we have an interesting halacha, and that is the detached fruit. And as Rashi points out over here, it doesn't have to be fruit; it could really be any movable. So who is going to be the possessor of that? So whoever gets there first. Very interesting halacha. Kansa reikish lechol davar. Once he marries her, so now what is the yavam and yavama? They're called husband and wife. Bilvad, however, with one proviso, she tehek suvasa al nechse bala rishon. So, and that one proviso is that her ksuva the security of her ksuva is coming from the estate of the deceased brother. And he cannot say to her, here, let's designate a certain amount of money for your ksuva. The entire estate of the first brother is going to be earmarked for the ksuva. Now, let me explain this a little bit better, and this will become clear in the Gemara, but just give me a moment to explain it right now. Generally speaking, a man marries a woman. Okay, good. That means now that he has to write her ksuva, and that means that he's on the hook. Where, upon death or divorce, he's going to have to pay his wife, or his estate's going to have to pay his wife a certain amount of money. Okay. And we also know that your property is going to be secured against that obligation. Right. Is your property locked? In other words, with your properties, can you not buy and sell your properties? Or I should say, rather, sell. Can you not sell your properties because of the ksuva? Right. So, now there is a shibud against those properties, so that in the event that, let's say, he dies, or let's say he divorces her, and he's got no assets, so then she has a lien on those properties, but is he locked now, and can he not sell those properties so that we know the halacha is? No, they're not locked. In other words, he wants to sell a property, he may do so. Obviously, you know, hopefully he'll be honest and fair, and he'll tell the buyer, you know, there's a lien on this property. I mean, but there's not a, it's not a real lien. And what I mean by that is that you don't know, and right, may not happen. But there is a possibility. But his properties are not locked. And this is where we're going to now draw a distinction. Where, when a Yavam does a mitzvah of Yibum, and although he does inherit the estate of his brother, but here now becomes the story of that estate that he just inherited. That estate is locked. He cannot sell a single blade of grass from that property that he inherited from his dead brother, because that is not only secured against the ksuva of his wife, but it's a
that's a big IOU.
Yeah, correct. It doesn't just serve as a lien. That right, it is. And even if the property that he gets from his brother far exceeds the value of his wife's ksuva, of his Yavama's ksuva, now his wife, still all those properties are frozen, and the only thing he can enjoy from that property is the payros that come off that property. It is an interesting halacha. We're going to be discussing more of it over the course of today.
It's as though it's hers. Right?
I don't understand why the Chachamim didn't do this in all cases, like a bank would.
Correct. In other words, right. All right. I'll sell my property. The bank will look at me and say, "You got to be kidding me!" Right? But not with that mortgage.
Right.
So good. I understood. But it's not. In other words, it's not a traditional lien in that you don't know if he's going to have to pay it. In other words, it's an obligation that may never come into fruition. So okay. So I'm sorry.
If you use that it's really not a fixed obligation. It's an obligation that really may come in.
If the marriage doesn't last, it's all hers, right?
If the marriage doesn't last, what?
Not all
the land is hers. Whatever's the value of the ksuva is going to go to her. Okay, so the Harei Ksuva Sa Menechas Al Shulchan Ela Kol Nechas Avachran L'Ksuva Sa Girsha Ein La L'Ksuva. Now, if he divorces her, so obviously he doesn't have to give her all the land. In other words, the only thing he has to give her is the value of the Ksuva. Hechzira. Now, the Mishnah kind of like hinting to us, like, here's a strategy. Meaning, let's say you want to unlock your brother's estate. Oh, okay. It's like, it's almost as if the Mishnah is like winking at us. So you want to unlock the your brother's estate. So how about this? You divorce her, and you only have to pay her the ksuva. Then you remarry her, hechzira. Excuse me, harei kachol anashim ein la ksuva bavad. So then she's like a regular wife. Now, what does the Mishnah mean when it says like a regular wife? We go back to what we said earlier. In other words, as a regular wife, you're only going to need to pay her the ksuva. And your lands are not frozen, your properties are no longer frozen, and the property that you inherited from your brother, that too is no longer frozen, and you could do whatever business you want with those properties.
Because he paid the
ketubah. Now, okay, the Gemara touches on a basic question, and that is the Shomer Yavam who dies. So who is responsible to bury her? So I know with the in a world of chesed, like in other words, we wouldn't be asking the question. Somebody would be burying her, but we're talking now about the financial obligation. So Yorsha Abal Kavra Deloka. I'm sorry. So Mi Kavra Yorsha Abal Kavra La Dekar Yarsik Suva. On the one hand, the husband who was Yarishik Suva, so maybe he has the responsibility to bury her. Or Dilma Yorsha Av Kavra La Dekar Yarsin Echasim. On the other hand, the father is her father, I should say, is going to be inheriting her nechsem alog. So maybe he has a responsibility to bury her. Meaning, let's spell this out. Generally speaking, in the case of a regular marriage, when a woman is married and she dies, so it's the husband's responsibility to bury her. But on the other hand, we learned back in the Gemara, back on Mem Zion, yeah, the husband's obligated to bury her. But think about it, he inherits everything. He gets her entire estate. A husband inherits his wife's assets. And therefore, the Chachamim said, you just got a windfall, you're going to have the financial obligation to bury her. Here, the Shomeris Yavam, it's not that simple. Because not all the assets go to the husband. Husband gets, in other words, and by the way, when I say husband over here, she's a Shomeris Yavam. I don't really mean husband. I mean, you know, the brother who didn't do the mitzvah of Yibum. So here now, because he didn't do the mitzvah of Yibum, so her estate's going to get scattered. Some of the estate is going to go to the Yavam, but some of the estate is going to go to her family. The Tzon Barzel may go to the husband, the Yavam. That's not perfectly clear, like we point down the Mishnah. The Malog property goes to her family. So and again, we're following the Beis Hillel model. So good. So now, if the husband inherited her entire estate, so it's a no-brainer, he's going to bury her. But now we're discussing a scenario where it's her estate gets scattered. So who then becomes the primary person responsible for a burial? Financially obligated. I'm Rav Amram Tashma Detanya. So the Gemara says, well, let's look at the following braisa. Yorsha, Yorshik Suva, Chayim Bikvurasa. The Yorsha, Yorshik Suva are obligated to bury her. So the one who inherits the ksuva. Take a look at the first Rashi on the Amud. Osen Yorshin Shiyorshin Ksuva Sa Chayim Bikvura. Whoever gets the ksuva is going to be obligated to bury her. So Amar Abaye Avanami Tanina. The Gemara says, good, we learned the same thing as well. Amanini Zonis Menichse Yisomim Mamasi Adesh Lahem. A widow gets supported by the estate, and her earnings go back to the estate. The Ein Chayav Bikvura Sa. They're not obligated to bury her. Yorsha Yorshin Ksuva Sa Chayim Bikvura Sa. Whoever inherits her, the Yorshe Ksuva, the inheritor of the Ksuva, are responsible to bury her. Ezu Amanish Yeshla Shnei Yorshim. Now, is there such a thing as a widow who has multiple Yorshim? Meaning, look at that line once again. Yorsheha Yorshe Ksuvasa. Right? The inheritor is the inheritor of a Ksuva. What are we talking about? A woman dies and she has multiple inheritors. Yeah, you know which widow that's going to be? The widow who's going to die is going to have multiple inheritors. Is going to be the Shomeris Yavam. She will have multiple inheritors, and therefore the ones who inherit her ksuva are the ones who are going to be responsible to bury her. Amar Rav Avalema. And so the Gemara says, so the one inheriting the ksuva is going to bury her. That means the brother. So the Gemara says, "Achani yoresh ishto einani kover." So the Gemara says, Rava says, look, why can't his argument be as follows? Let me inherit my brother's estate, but ishto einani kover. I'm not going to, in other words, I'm not financially obligated to bury the wife. I should inherit that as well. So in other words, if I marry her, fine. So in other words, so we're husband and wife, I understand. But over here, I didn't marry her. So I'm alei abay mishum debayin alav mishnei tzadim. So the Gemara says, look, here's the counter argument to that. Im achiv yoreish yikbor dishto. Im eino kover dishto yitink suvasa. So look, here are your options. If you inherit your brother, so then you're going to bury his wife. In other words, you're going to basically step into the role of your brother. Stepping into the role of your brother would have buried her. In other words, he would have had the obligation to do so. So you do so as well. And he may not cover Adishto. Now, if you're deciding that you're not going to bury her, so you take Ksuvasa. So then you're going to have to forfeit the Ksuva, because the Ksuva was there in exchange for the burial. Amrle Hachli Kamina. So the Sarava says, well, let me try to clarify my point a little bit better. Achani Yoresh es ishto einani kover v'imishim ksuva. Look, if the issue over here is ksuva, so lo nina ksuva lagabos mechayim. Wait a second. The ksuva is not collected as long as the husband's alive. And over here, okay, get ready for this, the husband's still alive. Now, what does that mean, the husband's still alive? Meaning, her husband's dead. On the other hand, I'm assuming the role of the husband, meaning I'm b'makom achi. So if you're telling me that I gotta bury her on account of the fact that I'm the husband and the burial's in exchange for the ksuva, okay, but that means I'm alive. You don't collect the ksuva mechayim so much. I'm alei diyisleim edrush ksuva beishamai. So the Gemara says, now wait one second. So what we're doing over here is we're analyzing the words of the Ksuva. And in the words of the Ksuva, I'm sorry, and who does analysis of the words of the Ksuva? That's Beit Shammai. And we know that according to Beit Shammai, Shtaro Milagabas Kegabo Idame. We have a concept according to Beit Shammai that expresses itself a number of times through Shas, and that's the following. If you have a note, a collectible note, we view that receivable as if it's already collected. How do we know that? Denan. The Gemara, we go over Mishnah that we learned together. Let's say we have the following. We have a Sota, a woman who acted inappropriately. She secluded herself with a man that her husband warned her not to. We don't know what happened in that room. So what happens? We have to take her to the Beis HaMikdash. She has to drink the water. Let's say, en route to the Beis HaMikdash, so the husband dies before she got a chance to drink. Beit Shammai omrim not los ksuva velo shoso. So Beit Shammai is of the opinion that she collects her ksuva and she does not drink. Ubeit Sila omrim shoso so lo not los ksuva sa. And Beit Sila is of the opinion that, look, here's your choices: either she drinks or she takes or she doesn't collect her ksuva. So the Gemara says, what kind of option is that? Now we know it's a basic rule. She can't drink the mesota unless her husband's alive. What Beit Sila simply means is, because she can't drink, therefore she doesn't collect her ksuva. Beit Shammai omrim no los ksuva v'lo shosos. So now we're going to go over the opinion of Beit Shammai. She collects her ksuva. V'amai sveiko hu safik zanai safik lo zanai v'kasa safik mosi midei v'adai. So the Gemara says, in analysis, how in the world can she collect her ksuva? She may have committed adultery. Now again, we don't know.
She loses.
We don't know what happened in that room, but she may have committed adultery. Now, if she did commit adultery, that's an absolute forfeiture of iksuva. So now she may have committed adultery. So let's go over the basic rules. Basic rules are, she now is suffic entitled to her iksuva. We also know that who right now is the holder of that money? The estate. She's coming to collect from the estate. Ain't suffic mosi mi devadai. How can her suffic right to claim the ksuva allow her to go to the estate and collect the ksuva? Kasavri Beit Shammai. So here an explanation. The Gemara says Beit Shammai is of the opinion that shtar omer legavos kegavo idame. So Beit Shammai is of the opinion that she has a ksuva. That's a note. That's a receivable. So the way Beit Shammai views receivables as if they are already collected. And that means that according to Beit Shammai, she's not extracting money from the estate. She extracted money from the estate. That money already went to her. So the Gemara says, "Vahabi ina kishitinasi lachar titli mashikasov laichi v'leika." So the Gemara says, so now, with all that in mind, so the Gemara sets us up for the following question. And we'll end today with this. In the Ksuva, what does the Ksuva say? Kishitinasi la'achir, when I marry somebody else, titli mashikasov laichi. So then, I will collect the Ksuva. Meaning, a widow is stipulated in the Ksuva that she will be not receiving her Ksuva until she marries somebody else.
Oh, good. Davening has started and should start everywhere else.
So the Gemara says, when you marry somebody else, you'll take what you took. And over here, in the case of the Yavam, we don't have that. And so Ravashi says, fine. You know, in this context, to satisfy this clause of the Ksuva, the Yavam is like Acher. It's like somebody else. And so therefore, even though Beit Shammai says, nevertheless, the Yavam is treated like an outsider, and it's treated like an external, and so therefore you do have a satisfaction of the wording of the ksuva. Okay, we'll pause over here. Tomorrow we pick it up at the two dots on the bottom of the umbra.